Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Anytime I read a mining book, most of them are pretty much textbook-like. And there was one, Boom, Bust, Boom, that was very entertaining from start to finish, very educational. And Ernest, when your book came out, to me, it had that same sort of flavor of, okay, this is going to be very educational. This is also going to be very entertaining. And you know, you've written for Reuters for a number of years, and so you are a great writer. And when I had the chance to get you on the podcast, I kind of jumped at it because I want to pick your brain on critical minerals, oil, energy, the transition, but also as a writer, like your process and how that's evolved. And so I think where to start this conversation is a background on who you are, how you stumbled into what you do, and what your average day looks like.
Well, Brandon, great to be with you and great to be on the podcast. As you mentioned, I work at Reuters. I've been here almost 15 years and I write about the critical mineral space. And I've been focusing on energy topics broadly since I joined Reuters in Times Square in New York all those years ago. I joined Reuters just as the U.S. shale boom was taking off, when it was sparked by a lot of technological developments around fracking and directional drilling. And for many years, I would basically take trips out of New York to go to parts of Pennsylvania or Ohio that were seeing a lot of directional drilling and fracking really exploit many of the shale formations there, and to other places across the US and Texas and elsewhere. In 2014, I decided to move with Reuters to Williston, North Dakota, which is on the far west edge of the state, right on the Montana border. And this is the epicenter of the oil and gas industry in the state of North Dakota. And my rent actually in Williston was more than double what I was paying in New York City, which tells you a little bit about the supply and demand equation at that point. Billions of dollars flowing through the state of North Dakota, people from all over the world flying in to invest in the state's oil industry and related services, whether that's real estate or food services, et cetera. You can just imagine this sheer influx of humanity into this once pretty rural state. And then I decided to move to Houston a few years after that to write about big oil and OPEC. So Exxon, Chevron, Occidental, and other big oil and gas companies that really help supply most of the world's petroleum-based products. I did that for a few years. And then in 2018, decided to really investigate this nascent space of lithium and other critical minerals. Nascent might not be the right word. I should say it was smaller then, certainly, than it is now. But I was intrigued about the growth potential for this energy transition that a lot of folks were heralding sort of just over the horizon. And I dove into this space with a big curiosity about what it would mean for the U.S. especially to produce more of its critical minerals, especially given what a lot of people in D.C. and elsewhere were saying was sort of the import given the need to fight climate change. So I saw sort of two buckets, the folks saying we have to fight climate change, and also I could see electronics getting increasingly more commonplace in our everyday lives, not just with cell phones and laptop batteries, but everything else nowadays, it's powered by a lithium ion battery or an electronic device. And that's going to require critical minerals. And where are they going to come from? So these are sort of the big overarching questions that really helped underpin the book, The War Below. I wanted to bring this idea to folks of choice. What are the choices we're willing to make if we want a green energy transition, and where are we going to get them? We don't just show up to a store and have these things appear. You know, a Tesla doesn't grow on a tree. Yeah. So we have to be thinking about these basic building blocks for the products that power our everyday lives.
And so before the book, you got your start at Reuters, where you still work now. How did you get into Reuters, and when did writing become something that you thought you could do professionally?
Oh gosh, yeah. So before I was at Reuters, I was at the Associated Press for about 2 years, writing about general business and energy related topics. And I joined the Associated Press in the fall of 2007. And what was not long thereafter, the stock market crashed. A lot of the banking and financial underpinnings of the American economy certainly fell out, the bottom fell out. And so that was a really interesting time to have my start as a financial journalist. I was in graduate school before that, and then I was an English major. So I've always enjoyed writing. I've always enjoyed taking complex topics and helping people understand them after I've had a chance to digest them. And so that's always been my North Star as a writer, is to really get curious about emerging spaces or new people. I think every person has a story to tell. And so I enjoy meeting new people. I enjoy technology and what that means for our society and how different types of technology reinvent different portions of our society, like fracking with oil and gas or various technological advancements in the mining industry right now. And certainly electric vehicles are a fascinating space, but that's just one part of the energy transition. So I've always sort of enjoyed doing that and really exploring different ways of writing, different styles of telling stories. I think what's fascinating about journalism right now is that certainly the written word is a huge part of journalism, but as well as graphics, as well as certainly video and still photography that have been around for a while, podcasts like this and others. There's many different ways to tell stories now that are proliferating, I think, for the benefit of journalism and just storytelling in general. And so I think the more that those get out there, I think that for the better. But for me, I was just curious from the beginning about just telling good stories and helping understand the world from my end, and then helping others grapple with that as well.
Whenever I discuss or even have other knowledge workers on the podcast, which tends to be quite often because they're either, you know, investors or some other type of publisher, I'm always curious as like the day in the life of like what your day looks like, how much of it is split between reading and writing. You have this idea in your head on one side that, you know, a writer is just writing constantly 24/7, but then you have other ideas where most of the time should be spent reading and kind of cultivating ideas. So what is your ideal, maybe not ideal, but what does your average day look like as a writer?
Yeah, there's no average day, really. I mean, good writing is informed by good reporting. And so you're always talking to a lot of different people to try to understand the situation, try to understand all of the sides. And some days you might be busy, like I might be busy writing 5 stories. They might be short stories. And then some days it might be doing a deep dive on one story that might take me longer than that. So there's really no direct rubric. But I do find that the more people you talk to, the more you get a well-rounded story and that you are able to get something meatier than you would otherwise. I mean, every good story obviously should involve talking to a lot of different people to get their perspectives on it. But there really is no one-size-fits-all day, for me at least. And I would suspect for most journalists, there is not one-size-fits-all. But as a rule, good writing is informed by good reporting. So the more you talk to, more people you talk to, the better off your stories can be.
Do you set certain hours or blocks of time for the writing specifically? And sorry, I'm like nerding out on the writing part. I wanted to get all this out in the beginning so we can talk about all the critical mineral stuff later.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's different, but when I am ready to sit down and write, it's when I have done a lot of the reporting and know that I'm ready to sit down and I can sort of let the writing sort of commence. And usually it's much easier than if you try to sit down and write when you don't have a lot of the reporting done. So it's subjective. I don't mean to give you sort of an evasive answer, but it can depend on the situation and the context. Yeah, and it also depends on the length of the story and other factors. I mean, with the book, right, I mean, this built off of 6 years of reporting, and then I did additional reporting for that. I basically spent another 10 months and every free minute I had going and doing additional reporting across the United States and the world. And so I wrote some of the chapters when I was on the road. I wrote some chapters on every single weekend that I had a free minute. And then I did spend about a month just completely locking myself in a room and just finishing the writing. So those were sort of three stages, I guess, there you could say on the writing, but they were directly informed by actually going out and pounding the pavement, so to speak, across the Western US, across parts of Latin America, across other parts of the world.
And so let's dive into the book itself, The War Below. What is the general hypothesis for the book? And why do you think now is such an important time to release something like this?
Yeah, Brandon. So for me, I mean, this really is a book about choice and what are the choices we're willing to make if we want an energy transition and if we want all of these devices that are increasingly electronic. You know, if I learned one thing from writing a book is that you get to ask your audience one question, and that's the question I'm bringing here is, what are the choices we're willing to make? We're not having a discussion right now about where, how, and why we get the building blocks for all of these devices that power our lives. And I think we should be. And I really hope the book sparks a conversation about these necessary topics. We don't just, like I mentioned earlier, don't just show up to a store and get an iPhone, or, you know, Teslas don't grow on trees. And if we're not willing to have these discussions, then are we willing to have the building blocks of these products come from places that might not share our ESG standards or might use the control of these critical minerals as economic weapons? So these are the things that I really wanted to explore with the reader and bring to her or him as part of the writing. It's a very human story. It's not a book for investors or geologists. It's a book for everyday people because this is a topic that affects everyone. So that was really what I wanted to focus on in the writing, as well as not bringing my opinion to bear here. I really wanted to present a range of people and who are on all sides of this issue and let the reader determine what they think. Because I think that's important here as we spark this conversation.
You say that this is a human story. What are some examples? And let's start with lithium, just because it's top of my mind because the price is so bombed out, but it's also super linked to EVs and everybody thinks EVs, lithium. So you say this is a human story. How does lithium impact someone on the human level?
Well, I mean, so lithium powers lithium ion batteries, as the name obviously suggests. And so without lithium, you can't have a battery, you can't have a cell phone, you can't have a laptop, you can't have all these other devices that are out there. So it's not a short, on a pure day-to-day level, on a practical level, lithium is essential for all of these devices, just putting aside even electric vehicles. But what I mean by a human story and the way that I wrote this is looking at the people across the world that are for and against certain projects. And the main spine of The War Below is the story of this lithium deposit in Nevada, about 200 miles north of Las Vegas, that is this huge prolific deposit. It's intermingled with boron. It would be one of the largest supplies in North America. And unfortunately for the company that wants to develop it, though, it also is the site of this rare flower found nowhere else on the planet. And so what I mean by sort of personifying or telling a human story here is the book looks at the head of this lithium company that wants to develop this lithium mine. And we get to explore what makes him tick. We get to find out his history in the oil industry and how he used to be an oil industry executive, and producing lithium is his way of helping leave the planet cleaner than the one that he found. He wants basically to make that his legacy for his children and his grandchildren. On the other side, you've got a conservation group that says biodiversity is what matters, and this flower should be protected at all costs. And if we're going to let this flower die, does that mean that we have a slippery slope type argument here, and that everything else is just going to go extinct from there. And so we get to meet both of these individuals and learn what makes them tick. And that, I think, humanizes them and helps the reader understand, okay, what are the choices we're willing to make? Do we need to make a choice here? Can the mine and the flower coexist? If we just let everything alone and didn't do anything, would climate change mean the flower would go extinct anyhow? These are the kind of things that I think people need to think through. And I think oftentimes, especially in our current polarized political climate, it's very easy to castigate someone who might not share our specific beliefs as sort of other. But when we start to see people as human and understand that most people come at things from a pretty earnest perspective, then I think it can help us put a more rounded perception on what is a really complex issue.
Robert Friedland once said, and I'm gonna butcher the quote because it's, you know, I'm paraphrasing something he said, but he said something along the lines of, people in New York think ham sandwiches come from the refrigerator, but they don't realize that it comes from 30,000 pigs getting slaughtered at some factory farm, you know, out there in the country. Mm-hmm. And you can apply that to all these critical minerals in the book, right? So like, take lithium, where you have people that are on one side, these environmentalists that say, hey, you know, we're destroying the planet, like we need to transition. But on the other hand, you've got these miners that are saying, in order to do that, we've got to do a bunch of things that may, you know, in the short term, actually make the situation worse and may, you know, may make things look a lot worse, but it's actually going to help because you need the lithium to put in the batteries to power the electric cars. And so on one hand, did you like have this frustration where you're looking at both sides and you're like, why can't you guys just see the obvious need for one thing to exist in order for the other end goal to actually happen?
I mean, well, that's a fact. It's not a question, right? I mean, in order to have all these devices, we have to have mining. There's just no other way around that reality. Yeah, I mean, I think more people need to understand that reality. And that's part of the reason why I wrote the book. It really drew on my time covering the oil and gas industry when I would get a lot of questions from people, fracking, good or bad. Mm-hmm. And these people would be wearing maybe a polyester shirt, haven't driven a gasoline-powered vehicle and holding like a red Solo cup. And I would say, well, here are just three instances in the past few minutes where you are using a petroleum-based product. So you tell me, right, fracking, good or bad. And so I started to see a lot of the same questions come up when I reported more on the critical mineral space, with one noticeable exception. Most people agree on the need for critical minerals. I mean, some people, yeah, might say we shouldn't have oil or gas, or we shouldn't allow fracking. And so people tend to be more starkly situated in one or two opposing camps. Whereas I think nearly everyone that I've talked to for the book says critical minerals are needed, just not here. We don't want this mine here. It can be produced elsewhere. I just don't, mm-hmm, want to see it. Or there are indigenous rights reasons, or biodiversity reasons, or conservation reasons why it should not be here. And so the reality is that it's not my place to say, okay, whether or not those reasons are legitimate. But if, right, we're going to have these transitions, then we have to be saying, okay, where are we going to actually get them? Otherwise, you cannot have an energy transition and you cannot have these electronics. It's just a reality. And so that requires a collective grappling with. It's more like a point, I would say, for consumers to think about, even than the actors that are in the book.
And so when people say, like, this whole NIMBYism of like, yes, I need lithium and we need lithium, but just not in my backyard, where do they think that it's going to come from? Because right now, a lot of it's coming from China, but who knows what that relationship looks like in the next 5 to 10 years. And so when you ask them this question, what is the response? Is it, oh, we'll just figure that out at some point? Or is it more thought out than that?
Yeah, I mean, most people said, oh, well, this is not the place to have it. It should be done elsewhere. Or we should be using other technologies rather than like open pit mining to get lithium. We should be doing another way. So there is, not to like get too nerdy, but there is a nascent crop of technologies known as direct lithium extraction that, yep, some companies are investigating. It has worked on a small scale in like a laboratory setting or in a test setting, but it's never sort of actively produced lithium on a commercial setting, high volumes of this. Companies like Exxon and others are looking at it now. It's a pretty promising space. But if it is successful, then that would reduce our need for open pit mine. But we're not there yet. And so therein lies the rub, right? Some people I talked to for copper projects, for instance, there's a proposed copper project in northern Minnesota that would also produce cobalt and nickel. That's around a very water-rich region. Northern Minnesota borders the Great Lakes. And there's some concern that if a mine were developed, it could cause an acid seepage into the waterway. And so the common refrain that I got was, well, you shouldn't have a copper mine here because the potential danger to the watershed is quite high. So put a mine in Arizona where there is not a lot of water. Yep. And then people in Arizona would say, well, we can't have a mine here. This is chapter two of the book. I look at a proposed copper mine in Arizona. They would say, don't put a copper mine here. Copper mining requires a lot of water. So you should have it in a place that has a lot of water, like northern Minnesota. I mean, this is literally what happened, actually, as part of the reporting of the book. Each side told me this. So I did sort of, you know, that was sort of an internal chuckle there. And each side sort of has their points. But you know, you can't sort of just say we don't want it here, we want it elsewhere, and still want the copper. Or if you do, you have to be thinking about where are the places that we're willing to actually allow copper mining. So these are the complexities that I'm bringing to the reader in The War Below.
There's just so many conflicting ideas going on, because you could stretch the NIMBYism hard or just say, hey, we need it somewhere else. You've got guys like, again, Robert Friedland, they're building in the DRC, which is, you know, it's a highly volatile area. And you've got the problem there where the US, and I don't know what type of organization it is, but basically saying, hey, we need these minerals to come from foreign, you know, like crime-free, or like, you know, like less crime areas or something, like safe metals or something. Right. And you've got a problem there, because if you're shipping all this stuff out because you don't want it in your backyard, like, where's it going to go? I mean, and most of it's going to go to the DRC, but the DRC is fraught with terrorism and fraud and turmoil. And that conflicts with the other policy you have. And so, like, there's just this policy gridlock, it seems.
Yes, that's a very succinct way of putting it. The DRC, for better or worse, you know, does have a controversial mining industry. And one of the most controversial aspects is this practice of artisanal mining that basically is everyday people that will break onto mine sites or dig under their homes or nearby forests to try to get cobalt or other minerals out of the ground. And so they basically take pickaxe and shovel and start digging. Sometimes you can have children as young as 6 or 7 be part of this practice. Sometimes they get maimed, sometimes they get killed. And the rock that they dig ends up in these supply chains for copper refining. And it's very, very, very hard to trace where that cobalt ends up. So does it end up in common electronics that we use every single day? It's a very opaque supply chain. One of the chapters in the book, Brandon, I dive into the metals that are used to build a leaf blower. And it might sound like sort of a basic household appliance, because it is, but I wanted to take something that wasn't an electric vehicle. I wanted to take something that is increasingly going electric, like a leaf blower, and say, okay, well, where did the metals come from inside this household device that is now battery powered? Because most leaf blowers 20 years ago were powered by 2-stroke engines. Now a lot of them are going electric. And I got to tell you, Brandon, like, I got a lot of resources at my disposal for my job. I have a lot of contacts. I couldn't figure out where any of these critical minerals were extracted from. And I looked, I chronicled this in the book. I tried pretty hard to figure out, okay, where did they actually come from? And I didn't know if, artisanal mining operation in the Congo had extracted the cobalt, or if the copper came from Peru, where copper mining is extremely controversial because a lot of farmers have opposed it because these copper trucks are kicking up dust that kill all their crops. I couldn't figure any of this stuff out. And that's just one basic leaf blower. And now extrapolated across every single other electronic device that is increasingly popular in our everyday lives. And you start to see that this issue is so much more than just electric vehicles. It's about all these other devices that are out there. And if we don't want to think about where we get the sourcing, then we have to be comfortable with them being sourced at places like the DRC, where we might not agree with the ESG standards. I mean, I think it's fairly, I'm going to speak for you here and say, I'm pretty sure you would support child mining. Like, I don't think any of us on listening to this podcast would.
I would not support child mining.
Yeah. And so, but we don't really know where this supply chain is coming from. And so are we going to be comfortable with the concept of grappling with, should we have a cobalt mine in Idaho, for instance, where there is a cobalt deposit? But a lot of people for various reasons oppose having that project there. So these are things I hope people think through.
I feel like at some point writing this book must have just been very frustrating, because in one sense, you see the solution, right? You see the solution, it's there. But on the other sense, you see such opposition to the solution, even though the thing that they're opposing will eventually help them achieve their goal. Like, did you ever just like get halfway through the book and you're just like, this is insane?
Well, I was really at pains to take my own opinion and put it into the recesses here, because I really wanted to be a mirror for the reader and say, okay, these are the actors, these are the people that you need to be thinking through. And so that was what my thought pattern as I was writing the book. Is how can I tell the best story about the complexities that I hear? And there are many, using the people that have been gracious enough to give me of their time and their insight for these really, really complex topics. It was a huge labor of love, and it was just sort of like a keep my head down and keep writing kind of thing. And I had a pretty clear idea from the beginning of what I wanted to write and how I wanted to write it. And so it was just a matter of starting from A and going to Z and telling the best story that I knew how to tell. The tension is inherent, I think, when you read the book. And I think the complexities are there for us all to grapple with. But that's what I really wanted to bring to the reader here.
But the good thing about a podcast is we can discuss things that you didn't put in the book, and we can discuss your opinions now that the book is published to whatever degree you want. And so one thing I want to know is, did you have any preconceived ideas or opinions about whether it was the mining aspect or the environmental side that were challenged and or refuted by the time you finished the book?
I would say I shared a lot of ideas about, which I think a lot of people share in common, is that there's often just two sides to an issue. And especially in our current polarized climate, like, you think, oh, it'd just be like, this company wants to mine, and here's the group that's opposing them. And that does tend to be more of the case in the oil and gas industry. But what I discovered the more I reported on this is sort of the sheer complexities around the multifaceted sides to all of these issues. Like, it's not just one side versus another. Usually you've got three or four sides, and they're all opposing each other, and they all sort of want their opinions to be heard and to ultimately win. And so that was something that, I'm not going to say I didn't necessarily expect, but I guess I hadn't really fully thought through sort of how each project that I chronicle in the book could have multiple perspectives that each are opposing each other or might have some areas of agreement on small slivers of overlap. Like, a great example is the Resolution Copper Project in Arizona. This is a project about an hour east of Phoenix. It's an underground copper deposit that would supply more than a quarter of the United States copper needs. Copper, hugely important for electrification. It goes into wiring, it goes into motors, it goes into construction equipment like pipes, et cetera. And so this, you can obviously see why this project would be appealing. But if it were developed, it would cause this giant crater that would destroy a site of religious significance to the San Carlos Apache people. And so at the surface, you would think, okay, here's a mining company fighting indigenous group. But there's also the nearby town, which wants the mine developed for economic reasons. The average income in that town is about $20,000 US a year. The mine would pay an average of $100,000 US a year. You can just do the math and you can understand why the town really, really wants it. But that doesn't mean the town bends over for the mining company. It has been very strongly supportive of its own socioeconomic development. And we learn in the book that the mining company offered X dollars for various social services, and the town did its own homework and realized that, no, actually, we are going to need 2x or 3x. I have to check the numbers in the book. But in any event, that this was a town saying, advocating for itself and saying that we're not going to take one side or the other here. Our side that we're going to take is ours. And then you've got the U.S. presidential administration. I mean, President Trump approved this mine not long before he left office. President Biden unapproved it. So there's huge politics that are involved here, especially because President Biden won the state of Arizona, given the indigenous vote. And so there's huge complexities here. And those are just four angles there. You know, we haven't even gotten to some of the others that are connected here. And so they're all vastly important and they're all interconnected, but they're each coming at it from their own perspectives here. And so that just makes it a lot more complicated from a storytelling perspective. But for me as the author, it really underscored the need to present to the audience that things aren't always black and white. In fact, rarely are they black and white. There's multiple angles to multiple stories, and they each need to be told with respect and with nuance so that people can best determine for themselves their perspectives.
You mentioned there's multiple angles to different stories, different themes, whether it's lithium, copper, and, you know, I've spent a lot of time on copper. It's one of the metals I'm kind of most excited about, because if you think about our global industrial system, copper is basically the blood vessels that power everything.
Dr. Copper.
Yeah, exactly. And so maybe we can stick with copper here for this example, but was there an interview or an angle to the copper story that had the biggest impact on you? And it could be an interview that didn't make it into the book. It could be, you know, something that either confirmed what you believed and you were just like, wow, I didn't know it was that bad or good, or maybe it was something that completely caught you off guard.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, copper, as you say, hugely important just for the lifeblood of the global economy. I really enjoyed visiting the Morenci mine in Arizona. This is a mine that's been around for 100 years. And so much of the book looks at projects that are in stasis right now that have not got permits or have not got regulatory approval in one way, shape, or form. So it was important to actually show a mine that is working, that has been around for more than 100 years, and that is run by one of the world's largest copper mining companies. And so one of the chapters looks at Morenci itself. It's this massive, massive operation, and you get a sense of the scale in the chapter, and got to interview the CEO of the company that runs this, Freeport-McMoRan, the CEO, Richard Adkerson, and fascinating interview, really got to unpack how the company looks at the copper industry, how it made the strategic decisions around that asset, as well as other assets it used to control elsewhere in the world. And you just get a sense of all of the moving parts in the mining industry. I think it can be even daunting for people in oil and gas to realize the sheer complexities that are in the mining space, right? I mean, yeah. I don't mean too basic, but oil and gas, you put a straw in the ground and there's, you know, obviously a lot more to it, but there's, you know, that's sort of the basic with a lot of pipes and subsurface geology. It's involved there. With mining, you have to certainly have subsurface geology, as well as so many other divisions, really, to actually get the rock out of the ground and then to process it and then to get it to market. There's just so many moving parts, copper especially. And there's multiple ways to produce copper, which Freeport walked me through and we explain in the book. And so this was just a great, not only Richard Adkerson, but Kathleen Quirk, the president, who actually just as of last week became CEO. Richard Adkerson is retiring. So talking with both of them for the book, I think really gave the reader a front row seat to what it's like to run one of the world's largest copper mining companies and North America's largest mine, period.
I'm going to ask you to nerd out on copper because that's what I like. And
sure.
And you mentioned with oil and gas, for, you know, to overgeneralize, you stick a straw in the ground and out comes oil if you're successful. I think on the same hand, a lot of people view mining as something very simple where you dig a hole in the middle of the ground out in the middle of nowhere and you find things that, you know, shiny objects, and you put those in a leaching bath or in some sort of crusher and you ship it off. And so, like, I think there is also that tendency to overgeneralize, like an open pit mine. Obviously, underground is completely different in terms of complexity. But when you walked through that mine with the FCX management team, what was the complex part about it that really kind of rocked your world from a comprehension standpoint?
I think just the size. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I remember seeing a leaching pad that was I'm going to get the measurements wrong, but at least 400 feet tall and at least 2 miles long. And it had just been built up multiple years. And it was just amazing. And you could see at the very top sort of the spigots that were spraying acid onto this to leach out copper out of the old tailings.
Yep.
And you just got a sense of the history, because this had been there, obviously built up over many, many years. And the technological advancements from when that initial pile was put there to now knowing it by spraying a certain concoction of acid and or bacteria, that you can then pull out more copper at low concentrations that hadn't been accessible before. And that's just one way of the multiple ways that the company produces copper at the site. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling to think about. Another example is, I remember going to the administration building for the mine, and across the road, there's a big giant valley, and you can see in the distance the tailing stack. And they were explaining to me how eventually that tailing stack will grow and fill in the valley right across the road from the administrative building. And so we're now, you've got this, you know, big, iconic, beautiful, scenic valley. It'll actually grow to be a mountain in about 20 or 30 years right across the street, just as the mine continues to process and the tailings pile continues to grow. It was just sort of a massive, mind-boggling thing to think about. The scale was immense. And that's why it was important for me to include that in the book, In the War Below, yeah. Because I wanted to give the reader, put him or her actually physically there to show, not tell, what an actual modern huge mine looks like.
And you say, you mentioned tailings, like this mountain of tailings. For those that don't know, what are tailings in a copper mine?
Certainly, yeah. So when we think about a mine, think about grade. Grade is the percentage of metal and rock. So mm-hmm. a rough number is, let's just say you take 100 pounds out of the ground. An average grade for a copper mine, at least in North America, would be about 1% or less. At Morenci, the mine that I visited, it's about 0.5%. So that means that's about 99.5 pounds of rock in that 100-pound example that doesn't contain copper-ish, give or take. So that means you got to do something with that rock. And most of the time, you put it on a tailings pile. And because you use a lot of water and slurry, and you form a slurry when you process a metal out of a rock, I mean, that can often look like, you know, not to use a bit of a childhood example, but like a mud pie. And so you're just constantly piling this mud pie. And there's different engineering standards for tailings dams. And there's people that actually study the whole geology of tailings dam structures in school, and they do this for a living. So it's a fascinating space that I find really, really interesting. Sometimes tailings dams can collapse. One owned by a Brazilian iron ore company, Vale, collapsed about 4 or 5 years ago and sadly killed about 4 or 5 people. That was poorly designed and poorly maintained. But this is the most common way right now to store waste in the mining industry. There are some nascent efforts, and I talk about them in the book, to do what's called dry stack tailings, where you basically dry out the dirt before you store it. As you can imagine, though, Brandon, that makes it more expensive. And so it's not used by miners commonly.
And when you talk to these management teams, we'll keep using FCX as an example. Did you get into any like discussion on strategic thinking and trying to learn how these executives think about whether it's the future of the mine, the future of the metal, and capital allocation? Because one thing I want to know is like, how far do these executives think into the future? Because I think so many commodities traders or investors, they think like, oh, what's the price of copper, you know, today versus yesterday or today versus last year? Where, again, I keep going back to Friedland just because he's kind of the most vocal on this. But Robert Friedland has, you know, historically and famously like chastised analysts in earnings calls where analysts are asking about the short-term price of copper. And he's like, look, if you're in this because you're trying to guess copper's price next year, like do something else. So is there any sort of kind of similarities there when you talk to FCX management? Like, hey, like we're looking out 5 to 10 years, and that's kind of how we're investing because we think copper is going to be, you know, $7-$10 a pound or something.
Yeah. So they have not, as far as I can recall, put a specific dollar number on where they think copper is going, except to say up. And the management team at Freeport has been very vocal on multiple occasions with me and with others around their strong belief that there's not enough copper being produced right now at any mine across the world, regardless of owner, in order to supply the energy transition. And so given that disconnect, they believe and have been very open about this, that they think copper prices have to go up in order to incentivize more production. Freeport itself has an interesting portfolio. It is operating in Latin America. It is operating one of the world's largest mines of any type in Indonesia, the Grasberg mine, which is a copper and gold mine. And it also has multiple mines across the United States, including Morenci, the one that I visited. In the United States, interestingly, it has huge deposits next to a lot of its existing mines that it can grow into. This is a concept in the mining industry known as brownfield. And it can be easier to get a permit to expand next to an existing operation than it is to get a permit for a new operation, for obvious reasons. And so Freeport is in the enviable position, I would argue, of having this optionality at its disposal to grow there. Also, interestingly, in the United States, thanks to a mining law that's governed hard rock mining in most of the US since 1872, mining companies don't pay royalties to the US federal government on minerals they take out of US federal land. So that obviously is a huge benefit to companies like Freeport and others that operate in the Western United States. So, I mean, this strategy certainly isn't unique, I think, to this company. This idea of we need to be producing more copper, it has to come from somewhere. I think, Brendan, one of the things that I did talk with Freeport's management about in the book was this idea of getting workers. I found it fascinating that nobody really wants to work in the mining industry anymore, broadly. And this was a huge issue for Freeport in 2022, for instance, and then going into 2023, their copper production in the United States fell, not because of economic reasons or due to the pandemic or anything else, but because they just couldn't get enough people in the United States to actively want to be a miner. And that was a huge strategic flaw for them. And now they're trying to work with various universities and others to get more people interested in the industry. But it's a problem because it's tough work, right? Physically tough work to actually, you know, run a big giant piece of mining equipment, to be away from your family. Mines are often in pretty rural areas. So if you can't get your family to come with you, then maybe you're doing 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, or some other sort of arrangement. So even with the higher than average salary that mining industry workers can command, they're still having a hard time getting it. So this just gets further back to the idea that the broader book explores. It's, you know, this idea of choice. If it's not a career that people will choose, then where are the metals going to come from? You know, I put it all in a pot and say this is part of the tension really that we have to think through here.
Well, it's part of the pot that necessitates higher commodity prices, because if no one wants to work, you have to pay them more. Correct. And if other input costs go up, like equipment and diesel, and just like logistics, and, you know, God forbid the U.S. government decides, hey, if commodity producers are making a lot of money, maybe we slap on a 10 to 15% royalty, since you're digging up, you know, the U.S. government's land or something like that. And, you know, who knows if that'll happen. But when you look at the cost structure of mining and you walk through Freeport's, you know, mine operation, like, did they mention any sort of, you know, just issues with just cost inflation outside of labor, where, you know, it's just more expensive to mine copper today than it was 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, labor certainly is a huge issue, and it depends on the country you're in, right? I mean, in Western Australia, labor is an extremely high cost for whether you're an energy or a mining company, just point blank. Fuel is a huge cost as well for a lot of these companies. So a lot of these trucks are powered by diesel. That's slowly changing. And I think the mining industry is sort of the ideal place for electrification and automation. But we are not there yet. And so diesel is a huge cost. So Freeport and others have in the past 12 to 18 months talked about diesel costs as well. I would say labor, though, tends to be the number one concern right now from a cost perspective for the industry. To attract talent, you obviously have to your point, Brendan, obviously have to pay people to be involved here. Yep. And one of the things I saw that didn't really make it into the book was the costs that Freeport and other mining companies have to pay out in order to attract families. And so we visit a town that is near Morenci, and part of this didn't make the final cut, but this whole town is owned by the mining company. The town square, the town gym, the town pool, a lot of the town restaurants, the library, all of the houses, they're all owned by the mining company. The mine manager is the de facto town mayor, because you can't really vote for the town mayor because the whole town is owned by the mining company. And this is a mine in the middle of nowhere. And so basically your life is the mine if you're there. Starbucks is owned by the mining company. It was sort of fascinating to think through. Now, that's all part of the mine basically getting its social license to operate, getting the workers there, making sure they're having well-rounded lives. The cost for the family gym and pool, for instance, was $30 a month for an entire family, so relatively affordable. The community was very family-friendly, had a lot of schools and other activities set up there. But I think sort of this is a concept that most Americans wouldn't necessarily see as sort of perhaps part of their everyday lives or don't think through. It's sort of an idea that we think maybe has disappeared, but no, it's very much still common for this massive American company and its core copper project.
That's got to be almost like dystopian to go to a town owned by, you know, just any, I guess, major corporation. Because I think Disney tried to do that. Like Disney tried to create a town, I think, at one point, or like a city. But was it just kind of weird being in a place that was, you know, it's almost like the Truman Show, where everything's run and designed by like a Freeport MacMoran.
You know, I mean, it looked like a regular town, right? So, I mean, I wouldn't want to speak for the people that actually lived there for a time, but I mean, I've met a lot of people that say, you know, they loved it. This is what they're there for. They're working there, so it works for them. Yeah, but it was a town, right? You know, it had all the trappings of sort of what you would expect is like a Main Street Americana, and it had a grocery store, doctor, et cetera, et cetera. The only difference was it was owned by one company. And so I think, you know, if you enter into that community, you recognize, obviously, that's the reality.
You mentioned just owned by one company, and I literally pictured you go to your doctor's appointment and the doctor's got his scrubs on, and it's just like the Freeport MacMoran logo right on his scrubs, and everybody's wearing like a Freeport MacMoran logo, like in whatever occupation they have.
I mean, perhaps, I don't know. I thankfully did not need medical care when I was there. So,
so we've covered lithium and copper, but you mentioned earlier in the podcast, the War Below spans not just these two, you know, minerals, but a host of critical minerals. And what other metals or minerals do you discuss in the book? And maybe what were some that you wanted to include, but then got cut? Like, for instance, rare earth elements, I know are very, you know, a very popular one to discuss amongst the mining community.
Yeah. So the book actually looks at what I call sort of five buckets of critical minerals: lithium and copper, of course, nickel, cobalt, and rare earths. Lithium and copper are in the title because they tend to be, in my argument, the anchors of the energy transition. Lithium, of course, the powerhouse metal for the lithium ion battery, and copper is just important in every single electronic device on the planet. And we thought that, of course, those two would get the most eyeball attention. People would glob onto those and maybe recognize them more if they see them in the title. So the title is not meant to be exhaustive. We look at sort of these three other buckets as well in the book. Rare earths, especially. Rare earths are a grouping of 17 metals found on the periodic table. And not to get too geeky, but like they are not actually rare. What's rare is to find them in large quantities. And so there are several pockets of deposits in the United States, the biggest one being in Southern California, just over the border from Las Vegas. And I chronicle in one chapter the history of this deposit from its discovery and its growth into the largest source of these rare earths in the entire world during the 1960s and 1970s. And then China's realization that it had its own massive rare earth deposits and how it basically took over this industry in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. Now, rare earths have multiple uses in a lot of different electronics, but a great common everyday use that people would recognize is in their cell phone. It's the thing that vibrates is a rare earth magnet. And there are no substitutes. They're made with rare earths, as the name implies. And so right now, China controls about 80 to 90% of the global rare earths industry. Rare earths are also found in a lot of weapons that the Pentagon and other militaries across the world use. So things like fighter jets, they're used in those, laser-guided missiles, night vision goggles. So you'd imagine that if China cuts off exports of rare earths to the United States or other governments, that that could be a problem. And indeed, China did do that in 2010 to Japan. And yep. I chronicle in the book the journey of the ownership status of the rare earths mine in Southern California, known as the Mountain Pass Mine. It went bankrupt under several owners due to some environmental concerns. And then in the book, we explore how a consortium in a Delaware courtroom, a bankruptcy courtroom, bought this asset. It's a consortium of a Chicago hedge fund working with a minority partner from China, and they basically buy this asset out of bankruptcy court and try to resuscitate it. And so that's sort of the core part of the chapter here, sort of exploring the history of this asset that at once was the largest rare earth mine in the world, then went bankrupt as China grew its own rare earth industry, and then it was bought out of bankruptcy, ironically, with help from a Chinese minority partner. And so for me, that just underscored how a lot of these industries right now are truly international and truly overlapping. And one more thing for the reader to think through here.
And so when you look across this, you know, spectrum of lithium, copper, cobalt, nickel, rare earth elements, if you had to rank like which one or ones is, you know, the, I don't want to say the most screwed, because like, that's like a very like crude way to put it. But like, you look at the supply chain, you look at where things are now, you look at the logistics of all these things, like which metals or groups of metals like is the most vulnerable to severe supply shock in the next? Yeah, let's not put a timetable on, just say like which ones are the most vulnerable.
I think it depends, Brendan, where in the world you are and what mm-hmm. your end use markets are. So right now the US produces very little lithium. And so if the idea of being more energy independent, or at least the aims of the Inflation Reduction Act, are achieved, then that just by necessity requires more production in the United States, or at least in the region. And so that's just a reality. Copper, interestingly, is not considered a critical mineral by the US federal government, but it is by the European Union. So there's a lot of debate in mining circles about whether or not it should be considered a quote unquote critical mineral, the idea that you couldn't have an economy without it. I would argue that it's pretty critical to a lot of economic activity to have copper. Whether or not you consider it a quote unquote critical mineral is something that we could spend probably hours discussing. There's not a lot of nickel produced in the United States right now. There's only one nickel mine. It'll be depleted in a few years, and the U.S. doesn't have nickel processing capability. Very little cobalt produced in the country right now. I think I mentioned the project in Idaho that was mothballed due to low economic prices for cobalt. And the rare earths mine in California, it is mining right now, but it can't refine all of the rock that it takes out of the ground, so that's all shipped to China for processing in China. So just those five examples that I just gave underscore, I think, especially in light of the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, and other efforts coming out of DC, to look at ways to perhaps boost, if not domestic, then regional production of these critical minerals. And you could see how if any number of factors were to cut off those supply chains I just talked about, whether that's a conflict or a natural disaster or something else, then production of these key building blocks of our everyday lives would slow or come to a halt completely. I mean, just take lithium right now. That the biggest producing region, or one of the biggest, I should say, in the world is in northern Chile in the Atacama Desert. And here's where you've got two of the world's biggest lithium companies have giant salt pond operations that basically evaporate out lithium. It's a very long process. It takes a while, but it can be productive. So you take the lithium out of the ground there, you put it in these evaporation ponds, you produce lithium, you ship it to the coast of Chile, then you ship it across the Pacific Ocean to another processor in Asia, maybe China, where it's then processed into one of the two types of lithium that battery manufacturers like due to various reasons. That could be hydroxide or carbonate. And then it's put into a cathode, which is part of a battery, and then it's maybe put into a battery pack. And then you think maybe it's shipped back across the Pacific Ocean and say to an electric vehicle plant in the United States, where it's then put into an electric vehicle. And then maybe ship to a customer in Florida. Like, that's a really long supply chain that goes across the Pacific Ocean twice. And you can just imagine any number of factors could block that. Yep. And so it just underscores the need to think about perhaps there should be more regional production. And, you know, I can't help but think about the coronavirus pandemic. It was about 4 years ago this month, Brandon, that we all started grappling with the pandemic that was slowly growing across the world. And at least in the United States, realizing that there was no domestic mask production. So this most basic piece of medical equipment that was so iconic during the whole pandemic and so crucial during the pandemic, none of those masks were made in the United States. And I think that really taught a lot of Americans that supply chains matter, that this sort of once boring concept of where things come from is actually crucial to how we think about our everyday lives.
And I think if you draw that, you know, logic out to its end, doesn't that just end in, like, these prices have to be a lot higher for things like lithium and copper and all that if the goal is to domesticate a lot of the supply chain and a lot of the value chain? Because the benefit of decades of basically handing off all of this stuff to China or to low-cost Latin America is we got commodities for cheap and we got refined metals for cheap. But if all of that changes, and, you know, for the name of national defense, we have to secure this domestically, can you do that without a severe spike in the prices of these commodities?
Well, one of the things I've been curious about in my work at Reuters, and part of this is reflected in the book, is the idea of premium pricing for metals that are produced at high ESG standards or higher ESG standards than are common perhaps in some parts of the world right now. And so you're starting to see companies that are producing lithium or graphite or other critical minerals say, if we are going to produce in North America and we're going to guarantee to you that we respected indigenous rights, that we conserved our water usage, that we produced perhaps with solar power, that we paid our people a living wage, then we're going to expect a premium to what might be the current traded price of these metals that's out there. And while in the past you had some customers, well, let's be frank, most people shop based on price. That tends to be the number one factor, whether you're a large manufacturer or whether you're me or you at your local Walmart. Like, that tends to be a huge motivating factor for obvious reasons. But I think increasingly we're going to start to see people be willing to pay more if they know that certain metals are produced at certain standards. One of the chapters in the book, I explore the creation of this mining certification organization known as the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance. And this actually was started by Tiffany, the jewelry company, which you would normally think Tiffany would have a role in the energy transition. But about 10 or 15 years ago, it started to really grapple with these tough choices, like, where are we going to get gold and silver and platinum and other metals that are ethically sourced? Because Tiffany basically told itself, we're not a mining company, we're a jewelry company. Right. And so working with some other NGOs that helped create IRMA, and over about 10 or 15 years, they formed these standards. And it's a key way now that Ford, BMW, Microsoft, and others are saying they want to get their metals procured. They're saying if a mine isn't IRMA certified, we wouldn't want to get these minerals from them. And so not a lot of mines right now are IRMA certified. It's going to take time, but I start moving in that direction. And I think increasingly you're going to start to see people say there is definitely a cost sometimes to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And so do we expect to have a higher price associated with that? And when you have some companies and some countries producing more regardless of the market price, because either they're supported by their host government or elsewhere, that can flood the global economy with this and push down prices and make it uneconomical for some mines to actually operate. And so then what does that leave you? And, you know, X number of months later, reliant on the company that just flooded the market that might not be producing at the standards that you want. And so in order to make sure that you have an ethically sourced product, are you willing to pay more? I think increasingly consumers, especially in the electric vehicle space, are going to want to know that the car that they buy wasn't built with metals that were processed and produced by somebody making the equivalent of like $1 a day or something.
Yeah, or by like a 7-year-old.
Correct. Right. And I think what's the main selling point right now of electric vehicles? Zero emissions. Well, that's all well and good, but if it was produced under low ESG or horrendous standards, then that sort of balance, you know, it sort of crosses that benefit out. And so I think I'm curious to see where this goes in coming years, because I think this will be a huge bifurcation in the metals industry.
Yeah, I just think it's such a fun philosophical exercise, because when you really start to peel the onion back, there's a lot of gymnastics that people have to go through, where it's like, yes, I want zero emissions, but it's like, okay, are you comfortable with driving a vehicle that's battery was made by child slaves? You know, like, is that like, those are the mental exercises you have to have. And like, is one good or the other? And then you mention like these, basically the willingness to pay for something that's more ethically sourced. And I think that that price discovery is going to be a, just a great social experiment on the consumers willing to pay. Like, how far can that price bound go? It's like, if I go to Walmart, like, do I pay $5 for socks, you know, for wool socks that are made from unhappy sheep that were brutally murdered? Or do I pay $25 and the sheep are being fed oat milk lattes and, you know, being sung Andre Bocelli? Like, and am I willing to pay for that? And that's a great experiment, because like, I don't know the answer. Personally, I don't know the answer.
Right. I think increasingly consumers are going to have to grapple with those choices in the years ahead.
And so I know we've kind of talked for an hour and you've let me pick your brain and kind of nerd out on stuff. Are there any metals that didn't make the book that either you have a passion about covering, or maybe there's a war below two on the horizon, and stuff like tin, stuff like maybe palladium and platinum, you know, those, you know, PGMs that are used in catalytic converters. Are there any metals like that that have your attention, maybe even just like for Reuters and covering Reuters over the next couple of years?
So I would say that I was pretty focused from the beginning on writing about these five buckets of metals because of their widespread use in a lot of common everyday electronics. That is not to say that I think it's an exhaustive list. I do in one chapter look at antimony, which yep. is used to be a flame retardant. So you can imagine in some electric vehicle batteries that you can have thermal runaway, that having an antimony component in the battery would be a positive. The reason that I focused on that was because the antimony deposit in Idaho that I visit is intermingled with gold, and it attracted John Paulson, the famed gold investor, and mm-hmm. he helped basically financially underpin this company that wants to develop that. And so it was an interesting experiment for me to explore, or an area for me to explore, because here you have a company that wants to basically extract gold, but was able to use the green energy transition as one of its main arguments for why it should be able to allow to tap this deposit. And there's some other history involving World War II that you know, I'll leave for the reader to discover. That was not to say that I think antimony is sort of on the same level as lithium. I don't think it is, but I think it was an interesting aside to this broader debate. And so rather than focus on any other metal or mineral out there like palladium or something, what I hope the book does is just sort of more philosophically explore the idea of, we need more of these broad subsets of everything that's on the periodic table. We're going to need more of them, just broadly. They have to come from somewhere. And here are some that are extremely important: lithium, copper, cobalt, nickel, rare earths, and here are how they're used. But that's not to say that, like I said, that it's an exhaustive list. These are broader philosophical issues for us all to really sink our teeth into and explore.
You mentioned World War II. And I did a industry primer on tungsten, which had a little bit of antimony in it.
Yep.
And that was fascinating. And one of the things I learned is during World War II, the prices of some of these strategically critical minerals, whether it's, you know, tungsten or even copper and zinc, went up 400, 500, 600%. Sure. And do you think where we're sitting now, where you have this, for lack of a better term, unprecedented demand driver from ESG and from energy transition, electrification, while at the same time you have an increasing demand for national defense, strategic buildup, and, you know, potential military escalation? Like, do you think these two demand drivers that just so happen to be going at the same time, like, is this, are we in unprecedented territory from a demand perspective?
It would certainly seem that way on paper. And I think one of the main curiosities is why the copper price, for instance, isn't higher. You do see that based on some in industry comments from them, as well as analysts and other market observers. We'll start to see, I think, later this decade, as electric vehicles really go mainstream and we really start to have even more electronic gadgets and gizmos form our everyday lives. I think that will have a perhaps upward effect on some of these prices, but we'll see. It would just seem, based on pure supply and demand, that if we're not going to be producing more copper, for instance, and the demand is going to increase, that it will have some kind of effect on price. So we will see, but I wouldn't say the pain point is not there as yet. But we do know just broadly that demand is going to continue to grow. One of the things I talk about in the book is this expectation or warning perhaps from some analysts that we had wars in the 20th century over crude oil. Could we have wars and armed conflicts in the 21st century over copper? It's sort of mind-boggling to think about, but I think that just lays bare the sheer demand for copper and how people are increasingly hungry for this. And whoever really controls these critical minerals in the 21st century is going to control the 21st century economy the way that oil really defined control of the 20th century economy. And these are, you know, that's a heavy geopolitical thing to think through, but it's an important one.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, you could have a full 2-hour podcast just on the geopolitical aspects of copper and what a shortage would mean. I'm just throwing out ideas for future books, by the way, pro bono.
I like it.
So I'm gonna ask just a couple closing questions. You know, a couple that I ask every guest, but one that I want to know. You've spent the time to write this book from your seat, pure opinion. If you had unilateral control on how to fix the problems with our metals and with our critical minerals, what things would you enact on day one?
So one of the things I talk a lot about in the book, and this is a US focused policy discovery really that I came to, is oftentimes in Washington, one arm doesn't necessarily know or fully grasp what the other arm is doing. And I found example after example after example of this. And it would seem that for a goal that the policymakers in Washington have really set for themselves, that is electrification of more parts of the global economy, certainly most of the US federal fleet going fully electric, that is a goal that President Biden has set. It would seem that these parts need to be working together, have a whole of government approach. I talked, for instance, about the Resolution Copper Project, which we were talking about earlier, how President Trump had approved it just before leaving office, and then President Biden unapproved it. That's not the technical term, but I explore it in the book, but he basically unapproved it and put it on ice. But meanwhile, there was a related court case where people were sort of suing related to this, and President Biden's attorneys actually defended his right in court to give the mine away to anybody he wanted. It seemed like a very disjointed approach to this issue and kind of gives you a bit of whiplash. In the example we were talking about earlier with this rare flower at this lithium mine site in Nevada, the flower is under review for potentially being declared an endangered species. But at the same time, the Department of Energy is considering whether to lend the company $700 million. And, you know, I'll leave it to the reader to discover in the book what actually happens. But it was very confusing for me as I was writing this out and reporting this out to say, okay, well, how can you declare the flower endangered and then still lend money to the company? Can both of those things happen at the same time? Mm-hmm. And so those are just two examples of the many examples I found throughout the book of one arm of the federal government not necessarily knowing or paying attention to what the other part is doing. And so time and time again, from not only industry, but also conservationists and environmentalists and investors and others, I would hear a desire for more of a whole of government approach.
And stuff like that begs like very brash questions where you just say, what's more important, like this flower or a domestic secure supply of copper? And like, I'm sure it's way more complicated than that. And maybe the flower is like, you know, just some, it means something to some people there, or maybe it has some history, but like part of me goes there where it's like, seriously, what's more important, a flower, keeping one species of flower alive, or securing our own source of dependable copper.
Right. Well, the situation you just laid out there, I mean, that is the choice of the book, right? It's do we value biodiversity more? Do we value the lithium more? Do we value the flower more? If we let this flower go extinct, does that mean that we need to let certain animals go extinct in order to develop natural right. resources in other parts of the world? What are the choices that we're willing to make? And are either side right here, or are both sides right? Can the flower and the lithium coexist? Can they live in harmony together? And I don't think people are grappling with that right now, Brendan. I don't think they're actually having to wrestle with that tough concept. And it is, from my mind, that scenario is a perfect encapsulation of the tension that's here, of the war below, if you will.
Yeah.
Because we have to be having these discussions about where we want to get these building blocks. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves in a position where we are right now with crude oil, where a lot of the crude oil that the United States imports comes from elsewhere. And the U.S. does produce a lot of crude oil today, but it does import a lot as well and mm-hmm. relying on others. And so if we're not careful, we're going to be making some of the same mistakes economically that were made 100, 150 years ago.
And I think, and again, this is my opinion, I could be wrong, but I think The War Below is a great title, because what needs to happen is just an adult conversation about priorities and what our nation wants to prioritize. And I think once you have that, and you have to make tough choices, right? Because when you prioritize certain things, when you rank them, that means certain things are going to go. Certain things aren't going to get funding. Other things will. People will be upset. But for the safety of our country and for the safety of the security of minerals, that conversation needs to happen. And you're like, it's actually, you're seeing this play out also in California. I read today with offshore wind. I'm sure you've seen this as well, but California's got this, like, you know, call it this like strip of waterway or strip of water on its coast where I think it's Ørsted wants to build some offshore wind turbines. And you've got an environmental group out of California that's pushing back heavily, saying, hey, like, this is going to endanger the species in that area, whether it's whales or fish or something like that. And it's like, this is the prime example of what we're going to have to deal with if we want what we want. Like, we can't have our cake and eat it too. You just can't. And that's really what the crux of this whole book is about. And that's why I was excited to get you on the podcast.
Yeah, I you said it perfectly. I mean, it's the tough choices that we have to be really wrestling with as Americans, really, and as citizens of the world. And I focused a lot in the book specifically on projects in the United States on purpose, because I really want Americans to wrestle with these tough choices. I do look at places elsewhere in the world. There's a chapter on Bolivia for reasons that the reader will explore. But the U.S. especially has to be thinking about, where are the places that are too special to mine? Are there places too special to mine? Where are we willing to get the building blocks for the products that form our everyday lives? And if we don't want to mine some places, are we comfortable just maybe foregoing some of these devices, or not having as many, or not having them proliferate as much? And what would that mean for our economy? We're not having those discussions now, and I think we have to be having them, as you say.
Yeah, well, you know, Ernest, I'm sure you've heard this before, but the work that you've done with this book and bringing a lot of these discussions to light, they're going to do a lot of good for mining and for just our future when it comes to electrification. It's going to do a lot more good than you think. And I think the impact that your book is going to have is going to be far more reaching than you would expect. So seriously, thank you for putting in the work, because I think it's a great piece. And final two questions, I promise. The first one, where can people go to learn more about you? Obviously, buy the book. I'm going to put the link in. I don't have an affiliate subscription. You know, like, I'm not making money on this. I just think it's a good book that people should read. Where can people go to learn more, maybe reach out to you?
Yeah, first off, thanks for your time, Brandon. Really appreciate your interest in The War Below. People can find me on any of the socials out there. I'm on all the big ones, Twitter, now X, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. I also have a website at ErnestScheider.com, S-C-H-E-Y-D-E-R. And I love talking with folks on Twitter and LinkedIn and all the other socials. So please find me there, and happy to talk about the book with anyone that has any interest to dive further.
And then the last question I ask every guest, And we didn't have an outline for you, so this is completely, you know, off the cuff for you. But if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Dinner with any person from the past or present, who would it be and why? Gosh, that is a very, very good question. I would have to say Eleanor Roosevelt. She is the lead quote in my book. And her quote is, "It takes as much energy to wish as it does to plan." And for me, that quote really encapsulated this idea of choice. And she was a brash, bold thinker ahead of her time. And so I'd love to see what she thinks about where we are today and what her advice would be.
That's the first time someone said Eleanor Roosevelt on the podcast, I believe. So thank you. Thank you for saying someone new. Thank you for writing the book. Thank you for doing this podcast. And I hope a lot of people buy it. And I hope a lot of people start asking these questions and having these dialogues. So thanks again, Ernest, so much. And best of luck the rest of the year. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, marhelm.com to get your discount today. This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.